Good evening and welcome back to another show of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned for the next hour as I interview two superstar guests we should be proud to have as Alaskans. First off, I'll bring back Deb Spencer, who was on a couple weeks ago. We had technical difficulties, so she'll be on here in a few minutes. She's owner of Cross Sound Seafoods and Scow Girls, an all-female floating fish operation near Pelican, Alaska. And in the second part of the show, from 7:30 to 8 p.m., I will be talking with well-known Alaskan artist Ray Troll and how the fin art of Ray Troll has impacted Alaska and elsewhere around our country and the world. You can participate in the show by writing in questions on Facebook, or you can follow me on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And before we get started, in the spirit of Halloween this evening, I'd like to highlight really quickly Denali Shivens, a four-year-old who recently won awards for his cooking at the Great Pumpkin Festival earlier this month. He took home ribbons for Best Pumpkin Cake and Reserve Grand Champion overall. The competition wasn't all children either. He was competing with mostly adults, says the article written by Melissa Griffiths in the Juneau Empire that now has apparently been picked up by the AP outside of Alaska. Quote, I have to bake a lot if I'm going to be a chef when I grow up, he states. He plans to have a restaurant which will have lots of toys, he says, and the currently favored name for his restaurant is called Salmon Tornado, a play on the name of the restaurant, The Twisted Fish. You can find his article and winning pumpkin cake recipe at the Juneau Empire website online. Deb Spencer is owner of Cross Sound Seafoods and Scow Girls, which is also known as Shoreline Scow, an all-female floating fish operation near Pelican, Alaska. The Scow was originally built by the late John Clausen and later acquired by Deb Spencer and Keith Heller. If you're listening and close to a computer tonight and you want to look at some pictures of Deb's Scow to kind of match the interview we're going to have, there are some images of this summer's fishing season on the Scow, which is Keith Thompson Photography at ktphoto.smugmug.com. And the sixth album down on the right, it says Scow Girl, so you can look at some of those pictures. Deb, are you out there?
I'm here.
Are you available? Great. It's good to hear your voice come over the air.
We made it.
We made it. Yay. So I guess let's first start talking about one of your business operations, which is called Cross Sound Seafoods. Can you give us a little bit of background about this company that you started?
Well, my husband and I started it actually quite a while ago. We started doing a little bit of custom processing when Pelican Seafoods was still operating, and then they started having some trouble, and we were using their facilities and leasing their space, and so we decided to kind of build our own little place, and so we kind of took the time to do it the knucklehead way and kind of built it all ourselves and milled lumber and, you know, kind of built it from the ground up ourselves. So it took us a little while, but I think we started milling lumber in 04, and I think we moved our first fish out of there in 07.
Okay.
So, and so what we're doing is the whole goal there was to have a place that we could take real high-end troll fish and move it directly to restaurants and fish markets in lower 48. So,
okay. For those out there that might not know what a troll fish is, could you just explain that real quick?
Oh, okay. So it's one of the gear groups for catching salmon. There's seining and mm-hmm. and gill netting and trolling. And so trolling is the hook and line fishery that catches salmon.
Okay. Good. Pause. Unpause. So besides Cross Sound Seafoods, you also have another business. Is it separate called Scow Girls?
Actually, it's called Shoreline.
Shoreline,
and,
okay.
And the
okay.
women who work there have become known as, Scow Girls.
Scow Girls. That's how it came.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's the Shoreline. And, and actually John Clausen named it that.
Okay.
27 years ago, I think.
So he was the original owner of the Shoreline Scow.
He and his wife, Betty, had a partner, Ginny, and John built it. And Ginny managed it, and about 12 years ago, we bought Ginny out.
Okay.
And so we were partners with John and Betty for really the past 11 years, and then John passed away last winter.
Yeah. So another term that a lot of people haven't heard, even though it's living in Alaska, is scow. So maybe let's just get some definitions or get a definition of what a scow is and how it operates.
Oh, well, actually the word scow is Dutch, and it just is the term for barge.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's good knowledge to have.
So, and we're, I guess, not technically a barge because we don't have a hull. We're a log float with flotation. So we have two big logs and beams across those and lots of foam flotation underneath. And so, it's, but it's, it looks like a barge. It's a big flat deck. It's about 56 by 26.
56 by 26, okay. And the idea, do most scows, I mean, had you seen other scows in Alaska before yours that was built? How did you model, like, the living quarters and everything?
Well, I didn't.
John did, yeah.
Thankfully inherited them.
Yeah.
And however, yeah, there used to be tons and tons of scows around. When I first moved to Pelican, even in 1990, good grief, there were probably at least a dozen scows in the vicinity. Either across in Murphy Cove, you know, across Cross Sound, Murphy Cove, Hockneyheim, Deer Harbor, yeah, Elfin Cove. And then all the major buyers each had a scow or several scows in, you know, strategic locations.
Yeah, yeah. Because growing
up commonplace.
In Southeast Alaska, I've never seen it growing up in a fishing family. And then, or I'm sorry, in South Central Alaska. Why do you think it's more common down here in Southeast?
You know, I can't really comment. I don't know the nature of the fisheries in South Central. I do know that they're pretty convenient for fishermen in terms of their, you know, they can deliver closer to the fishing grounds and get turned around more quickly and back out fishing. So
yeah.
I think that's why. In fact, they had them, I think, all through BC as well.
In British Columbia, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe just walk us through the fishermen come up, the operation of a scow. Fishermen come up, and then you guys, what happens after that? And how often do they dump?
Well, they pull up, and we hope they've pulled their poles before they pull up.
They're what? Their poles?
Their poles, yeah.
Poles.
Their poles. But anyway, they pull up alongside. And then we offload their fish, or they offload their fish. It just depends on how they're configured. They either can hand pitch them, or we have hydraulics to either pull bags or lift small totes off their boats. And so then we grade all their fish by species, and quality, and then, you know, weigh them all and we keep track, so we write them a fish ticket, so there's a record, and we can write them a check eventually. We're done with their whole load. And so we write them a check, and then all those fish get put into totes and all individually belly-ized, because all those fish are dressed at sea, so they all come to us cleaned, gutted.
Okay.
And we belly-ice each one into a tote, and when we fill up the tote, we roll it out to a storage place and put an empty in its place and start over again. And so then we, you know, of course, write the fisherman a check and give him ice if he needs to, and he can buy a few groceries if he's short on something. And we also have showers and laundry and a sauna and a hot tub.
Yeah, the picture showed kind of those totes as a hot tub as well.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yeah, sometimes we have to use that for fish.
It doubles as a hot tub.
It does, yeah. It's usually got a higher priority as a hot tub.
So the salmon are in the totes on ice, and how often do you have to take those to shore, and where are you taking the fish?
Well, we don't have to take them anywhere, thankfully.
Okay.
We have a great packer who comes usually every day from Huna. We're a contract buyer for Huna Cold Storage. So they come speedy. The Tattoo comes nearly every day. If it's slower, he comes every other day or so. And we load up, you know, all the fish totes onto him, and he brings us fresh ice. And we do kind of one of those little cube games that you played as a kid, sliding the little tiles around. So, you know, I'll give you 3 fish for your 4 ice, and we have space for this. And then he goes, and then he brings us groceries too and supplies from town.
Oh, okay. That's where the supplies come from.
He's kind of our lifeline, yes.
Has everybody ever been a problem where you didn't show up on the scheduled time?
Well, we're always in really good communication with him, so we know where he's at and when he's due. And so, yeah, sometimes it's, you know, he just shows up right at the right moment with the ice we need to ice the fish that we're buying at that moment. So,
Well, so how many pounds can you guys store in those totes in total?
I guess each tote is probably about 800 pounds of fish.
Okay.
I mean, it depends on the species. You know, you can get more pounds of coho than king salmon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can get on board. We just did a renovation this year, so we can get more fish on board now. And we can get about 30-some thousand pounds on board at one crack.
Okay.
It's pretty crowded. But
So is
usually Speedy's on his way.
Speedy. And this mainly is salmon, or are you taking other species of fish as well?
It's all, you know, targeted salmon, and then there's bycatch. So we get some, you know, lingcod when it's open and rockfish. And but, yeah, primarily salmon.
Okay. All right. So besides the day job, there's also the scow operation at night. You had quoted somewhere, mamas don't let your daughters grow up to be scow girls. what did you mean with this statement? Why not? Why can't a girl be a scow girl?
Well, I guess every year, you know, when I'm hiring crew, and usually we've been really fortunate in that we have crew that seems to return pretty frequently. And so that's a huge, I don't know, that's just a huge blessing, frankly. But anyway, it's just really hard work. And, it's pretty tricky to even describe it to people. And so I always see my job when I'm looking for a new deckhand is to try to talk them out of it, because it is so hard. And if I can't talk them out of it, then it might, and I guess, well, maybe they can cool it off. But, and, you know, the slogan, we started doing t-shirts a few years ago, and so every year I try to come up with some goofy little, you know, thing to put on t-shirts.
Like what?
come on,
you can tell.
Well,
us.
Actually, our anniversary shirts for 25 years said, I don't know, shoreline. Anyway, it just was 25 years of fish and chicks.
Of fish and chicks, and, that's cute.
Fish and chicks, yeah. And, I don't know, chicks with hydraulics 1 year. That's the definition for scow girl. So.
Cool. Does the team come up with an idea, or do you just kind of brainstorm?
We kind of bantered around a little bit. This last year, we put a bunch of new aluminum down on the decks, and so this year the shirt said diamond plate is a scow girl's best friend.
Diamond plate?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, which is the name for tread plate, so.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
so your women, you said you get different ones each year. You have a crew that kind of comes back year after year. Give us maybe profiles of some of these girls and how they met you, how you met them.
Well, some of them I've known since they were, like, I don't know, six.
Yeah.
I could tell you all kinds of stories that we only have a half an hour. anyway, some of them are homegrown pelican gals that I've known for a long time, and they're all off doing other things. You know, some of them are in grad school and are finishing grad school or in medical school, and nurse practitioners. So it's pretty varied, but really that's been one of the greatest things is kind of growing up with all of them. And so every year it's a little bit of a mix and match, like who can do this here and who's got this experience and who can fill in here. And and thankfully I've got a really good pool of amazing women to pull from. So,
And even though it's really hard, most of them last through the season.
Pardon me?
Because you said it's the hardest job you'll ever do. You've had most of them last through the season.
Oh yeah. I don't think not sure that we've had anybody that didn't. If somebody's having a hard time, I think everybody kind of knows it. And so we kind of, it doesn't happen. I mean, everybody has a hard time. It's really hard work, but we kind of pull together and get through it.
Support each other. So when you say hard, I mean, what time are you waking up in the morning and what time are you going to bed at night? Do you get time for
sometimes
lunch? What's a typical day maybe on the scale?
Some days you wake up at 11 and you knit all day and you go to bed at 8 o'clock at night.
Nice.
And you like buy two boats of fish. And then sometimes, you know, a boat sneaks in at like 5:30 in the morning and they think that you haven't heard them and you're all up anyway. And then you do fish all day. And, you know, you shove frozen burritos in each other's mouths and then you maybe get to bed at 3 a.m. and, you know, it's really varied. It's pretty unpredictable.
Every day is different. Now, on the fisherman part, do you get clients that are coming back throughout the season or new ones are coming in? How did they find you?
We hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got our usual, you know, the usual suspects that come, you know, that kind of just traditionally fish in that area and sell the scow. And then we also have there'll be people that, you know, kind of roll up from Craig at the end of the season and they're there for a couple trips or, you know, it just all really varies. But over the course of the season, there's probably, I didn't count this year. There's usually, you know, 90 to 100 or so boats that spin their way through there at least once, but, you know, most of them more than that. So
90 to 100, okay. All right. And how are some of the interactions with the fishermen? Have you ever had any problems with some of them or had to say, okay, yeah, you can't come back to our scow? Because, I mean, an all-female scow, right? And we're in Alaska. There's a lot of men. Some strange ones.
You know, somebody asked me that when I was down south. You know, like, oh wow, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and you're just women, aren't you afraid? And truly, it's like, it's about the safest place I feel on earth.
Hmm.
I really do. I mean, there's such a, I don't know, there's a good code there, and I know that if anything ever did happen, the moment we got on the radio, the problem would be over. It feels really, really safe.
So the Coast Guard knows that you guys are out there?
The Coast Guard is amazing, and they've, you know, I mean, they're the ones that save our butts. But if something even, you know, that didn't warrant the Coast Guard, I know that there are good guys in the fleet that would pull their gear and come help us.
Now, do you think there's kind of a business advantage of this all-female crew? I know I got a question from my sister specifically about it. Is it legal to run an all-female business? And if you've ever had a man apply for the job, I mean, do you have a labor issue there?
We've had guys work on the scow, absolutely.
Okay.
It seems, you know, the living quarters are pretty tight. And so it just seems to be a little easier to have women, you know, in close quarters and the living situation. Although, you know, obviously people do it all the time on boats. But So there's really, honestly, there's a pretty neat camaraderie that's built in the crew. And it's really kind of magical every year. When it works well, it's beautiful.
Mm. And then you guys celebrate at the end of the season when it's over, or do you sleep for a month?
Yes, both.
And I mean, if you're a new person, do you have initiation on the scow?
You know, it's kings are initiation enough. We don't have to add fuel to the fire.
Oh, the king salmon?
We open with king salmon every July 1, and usually that's the trial by fire. So, yeah, if they've made it through Kings, then they're probably going to be okay.
So if someone's sorry.
Oh, good. Oh, I was just going to say that two of the gals that were on there this year, actually they were both new, and it was during Kings, and they, you know, had back-to-back, I don't know, 18-hour days, and it was just, you know, busy. And one of them told me later that she'd gone upstairs and gotten something to eat and came back downstairs and just had this look on her face, and the other gal looked at her and just said, "Do you think this is what hell's like?"
Really? Wow, that's a good way to scare people off. Jeez. Wow. So if someone's out there listening and they haven't been scared off, would you accept applications? Could people write you if they were interested in working? I don't know if you have openings this summer.
Oh, you know, I don't know where we're at. I do know that it sounds like we're going to have a couple of returning people, and which I'm always hoping for. And then I sort of have a procedure for, you know, kind of, you know, of course, people who are returning have priority. And So my honest answer is I'm not exactly sure where we're at, and I try not to think about it till at least January.
Yeah, it's still early. Summer just ended.
Exactly. It feels like it anyway.
Not here in Tuna. Winter is upon us. So, you know, this is your operation, and you've made some remodeling recently, but what else do you see in the future with this operation for the SCOW? And do you have any dreams to go bigger or make it different or have more people? Or?
You know, when we were rebuilding it, you know, we got a lot of, oh, you got to make it bigger, you got to make it bigger. And I don't know, maybe I just lack vision or creativity or something. But I don't know. I don't know. Like for the future, I hope that it, whatever happens, I hope that it really can retain that old school feel about it. You know, I mean, it kind of is this throwback and to an earlier time, and I want that to stay, whatever happens, I guess. Yeah,
your little world out there.
That's kind of a non-answer, I'm sorry.
That's all right. well, before the half hour is up, I did want to get in Pelican as well, because it's a very unique community.
Good.
And maybe people out there have never been, people in Southeast or outside of Alaska. How would you describe Pelican to someone who's never been there?
Actually, I'm having that experience right now trying to describe Pelican to people in Bellingham for school, and it's kind of impossible. It's easier for a Juneau audience, I think, you know, especially folks who've been to Tanaki. You know, it's a little boardwalk community. It's incredibly beautiful, and people are wonderful, and it's, you know, a pretty tight little place, and it's a, you know, it's a place that's been struggling for some time, and the good news is it sounds like the city and Cape Tribal have come to an agreement to sell basically all of, my understanding is, and there could be new incarnations of this recently, but to sell all of Cape Tribal's holdings to the city, including the cold storage and the utility and the fuel dock. And so I think the biggest trouble that Pelican's had recently is it's just been really high-centered. You know, Cakes had the plant, and then it was in limbo with ownership, and the city foreclosed with the other owner, and so it was just all kind of in, you know, discombobulated. And so I think we've got some movement in a direction, and I think it's going to help things moving. And then the other bright note for fishermen is that this movement, this, you know, agreement between the city and Cake Tribal is going to allow the ICE grant from the salmon mitigation money. The city received $800,000 for refurbishing and replacing the ice machine at Pelican. And so, but the site that we wanted to use for that has been kind of tied up. So that's been kind of freed up. And so it looks like, I mean, right now everything is on track to have ice next season for the fleet. So,
and so that you haven't had ice before in Pelican?
For years and years, Pelican had, you know, the best ice in all of Southeast. It was kind of renowned. And then when the flume went out a couple of years ago, the water system, they didn't have enough water. I don't know all the technical stuff, but anyway, they had to stop making ice. and then the price of power went up because we were all on diesel, and so it's been, you know, pretty tricky on a lot of fronts in Pelican. But so the short story is that we should have ice there next summer, and the city has had some small ice making capacity at the top of the ramp to keep people going, you know, for a little bit of winter fishing and stuff. But you know, we need, you know, big kind of 60 ton capacity. So
So with that, it will bring in more fishermen in Pelican to spend the money and stay the night. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, good, because I was listening to a presentation the other day. Actually, every year our organization, the Juneau Economic Development Council, does these economic indicators, and they talked about population decline in Southeast. And Pelican, over the last 10 years, has lost 46% of its population. It's pretty scary. That was the biggest one in Southeast.
Yeah, it's pretty, definitely pretty noticeable. Yeah.
So that creates challenges. But there's a young mayor there, right? Do you think he has
kind
of a vision
absolutely.
To bring the city back or the town?
Yeah, you know, we're all extremely hopeful that this is a good first step, for sure. So, I think it's a step in the right direction. And, you know, you can't, it's taken years to get this way, so we can't, it's not going to be fixed overnight. But, I think it's a really good first step.
Yeah, definitely. Now, something else that's happened in Pelican, I think, that makes it unique maybe to other communities, is there was this celebration called the Boardwalk Boogie, which some here maybe might know about. I was hoping to go this year, but apparently it was canceled. Famous Colette organized it every year. What is that for those out there who might not know what the Boardwalk Boogie was?
Trying to give you what version of definition you want.
Well, the radio. G-rated.
It's been a music festival that happened in Pelican for good grief. I think it was 99. At first, it must have been, because I think that was the year 99, because that was the year we raised the totem pole, and I think that was the first Boardwalk Boogie that weekend. And then it's had, you know, various versions over the years, but then this past time we didn't have one. And it was, we missed it.
So hopefully that'll get revived in the future. It's called Let's Listening.
Exactly.
Or Eric Beeler, who also is a famous wood carver out there, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Amazing artist.
Yeah, he's in Pelican. Maybe I'll get him on the show in the future, too.
Oh, he'd be awesome.
Yeah, so... So any last thoughts, Deb? We're kind of winding up this half hour.
I don't know. I guess I didn't think about any last thoughts.
Well, you've done some amazing things.
It's sure been a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you, Adrian.
Yeah, thanks for calling in and talking about the SCOW as well as a little bit of Pelican to give some background on what you do. And good luck as the season comes up. And... I did put those pictures out there. If anybody's interested, there were some really good pictures that Keith Thompson took. That was at, that website again. Let me find that. It was ktphoto.smugmug.com, and you can go down to the 6th album on the right-hand side and see the SCOW girls to get an idea of what the SCOW looked like and the girls on board. I didn't see any pictures of you, Deb, though. It was just the girls. I was like, where's Deb?
Yeah.
There was a baby on one of the pictures. I had all these people say, what's that baby doing?
Oh, yeah, that is the Pagan's baby. That sounds awful.
Is that the family?
Right? Anyway, yeah, she was just a little, that was a couple years ago, I think.
Oh, okay.
She was 3 now. Yeah, just sweet. Sweet to have really young fishing families. So.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, great. Thank you, Deb, again. I've been pleased to have you on the show. Thanks again for calling in. For those listening, that was Deb Spencer. She's owner of Cross Sound Seafoods and SCOW Girls, female floating fish operation in Pelican. Thanks again, Deb.
strata. That's all you need to know to understand the world today. You gotta dig the dirt below. Of all these seeds and broccoli from ages long ago, a tale is told as truth reveals the knowledge.
Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned in the second half hour. The first half hour, we're speaking with Deb Spencer, owner of Cross Sound Seafoods and the Scow Girls. And here in the second half hour, from 7:30 to 8, we'll be speaking with Ray Troll, Alaskan artist, or a Finn artist, as he calls himself. From his tree-lined studio high on a hill above the Tongass Narrows in rain-swept Ketchikan, Alaska, Ray Troll draws and paints fishy images that migrate into museums, books, and magazines, and onto T-shirts sold around the planet. Ray earned a Bachelor's of Arts degree from Bethany College in Lindsberg, Kansas in 1977, and an MFA in Studio Arts from Washington State University in 1981. In 2008, he was awarded an honorary doctorate in fine arts from the University of Alaska Southeast. He has appeared on the Discovery Channel, lectured at Cornell, Harvard, and Yale, shown work at the Smithsonian, and has even had a ratfish named after him. Wow. Ray, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yes,
wow.
I like rat. There's that ratfish line. Yeah, good.
You put it at the very end of your bio, a ratfish.
Well, you know, you might lose people if you list it first. You know?
That's true. A New Zealand ratfish.
That's right.
Now, okay, so instead of starting at the beginning, most of my guests, I ask them kind of how you got started, but you mentioned the other day about how the line or image that people most remember you by is Spawn Till You Die, kind of this inspirational saying. Where did you get the inspiration for that, and what does it mean?
Well, I did that T-shirt in 1987, and actually, coincidentally, that was first... That was the year that Michelle and I had our first child, so spawning was definitely on my mind at the time. And it seems to be like the one image, you know, I'm frequently introduced as, you know, Ray Troll, who's that? Well, he's the Spawn Till You Die guy. So it seems to be like the one image. And actually, year after year, it's the one T-shirt that just kind of, it's a perennial. It just keeps selling, and it's usually at the number one position on the charts, in the old T-shirt charts, at least for us. And a couple years ago, there was one that actually did kind of nudge it out of the way, but then that's back. But Spawn Till You Die, what does it mean? Well, it means different things to different people.
I imagine that was my other question. What other people?
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of art. I don't, you know, I mean, it means one thing when you draw it and what I was thinking, and then over the years it begins to take on another meaning, and, you know, I mean, that's really, I kind of like to think of myself as an image maker and a phrase maker, and you combine the two, and it's interesting to see how people respond to it, and, you know, and it's, you really can interpret that one almost any way you like.
Any way you want.
Yeah.
And it's been worn by famous people, is what I read somewhere. T-shirts by famous musicians? Any?
Well, yeah, over the years I've spotted it here and there. I kind of have a little, actually in one of the galleries on my website, I have, you know, cultural sightings of Troll products. And that is the one that gets out there the most. It's been everywhere from, actually my favorite latest sighting has been, it was in a Ugandan action film.
No way.
Yeah, somebody sent me, one of my many Facebook friends said, hey, man, check out on YouTube, there's this Ugandan action film, and there's a guy wearing Spawn Till You Die. And, but then actually a couple weeks after that, somebody sent me a picture of Daniel Radcliffe sporting one, and that's none other than, that's Harry Potter.
Wow, that's
so
big.
Yeah.
That's probably the most famous person.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. Yeah, being sported around by Harry Potter.
Yeah, So STYD. Have you ever kept track of how many T-shirts you've sold?
I knew that we had hit the million mark about 1990-ish or something like that. So I'm guesstimating, and I've been at this for almost 30 years now. So 2 million-ish or something, but you know, it's spread out over. It's not like I'm a T-shirt millionaire or anything like that, but spread out over many decades.
Yes, of course.
But there have been a couple million that have been out there,
Nice.
And I expect that most Alaskans, at least most cool Alaskans, have at least one or two.
Yeah, well, I need to get one to be cool then.
What? What?
I'm sure I had one when I was a kid growing up.
I'm sorry, this interview is over. Oh, you had one when you were a kid.
I'm sure I did. I'll find it.
That's how old I am, yeah.
So speaking of Alaska and Alaskans, you know, I think I read it as well that you had four other brothers or sisters that came up here and lived, and it's a very special state, and we're all proud to be from this state. How do you think Alaska and Alaskans have shaped your identity as well as your art?
Oh, hugely. I didn't find a home till I got here. And, yeah, I'm from a family of six kids, and we were Air Force brats.
Mm.
And so we grew up in 11 different places, you know, around the planet, really. And so every two or three years, we were moving, and we were always perennially the new kids. And then, you know, after we all got our college degrees, there have been four of the six that made Alaska their home. So, So you may run into another troll here or there in Alaska. And my brother and a couple of sisters. I have a sister in Juneau, Kate, and. But basically, yeah, it was my siblings that kind of brought me here. My sister brought me up way back in the summer of 83. My sister Kate, she had a little seafood business. And she wanted me to come up and run. I came up to be a fishmonger.
Hmm.
So I was a monger of fish. And Kate brought me here, and like I said, I found my muse, and I found my home, and I found kind of what I wanted to talk about, I guess, in my art. And Alaska is pretty much the gateway to all that stuff. It's such a magical, cool place to be, and unlike any other place on the planet. And there really is something that strangely, you know, I really did feel like I'd found home when I got here.
Mm. Do you think you've contributed some way to Alaska?
Yeah, I've helped bring the moral level down. Every time I see a Spawn You Die T-shirt on a, you know, a youth, I go, yes, my job is
corrupting the youth.
Yeah, corrupting the youth. But you know, I have positive T-shirts too. You know, I have one that says, oh, I have a couple of public service announcements that are actually good things. And if you must smoke, smoke salmon.
Oh, that's good.
So that's a kind of a positive message. There's another one that says, do not drink like a fish.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's another positive thing.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I think over, it's been, I'm coming up on 30 years now almost, and now there's been entire generations that have grown up wearing my stuff or seeing it. And I do think that in one way or another I've had an effect.
Yeah.
I don't know, I shall leave that to people like you in the media to see if it's good or bad.
Make that decision. Now, speaking of humor, I had a listener ask me to ask you where you got this sense of humor and why do you think it's funny and how it kind of works for some of your audiences.
Well, where did I get my sense of humor? Well, through the course of my life, and you know, I was just remembering something earlier today. There was as a kid, just running with the whole, always being the new kid, and these Air Force bases and different places we would move to. You kind of had to, I don't know, you could reinvent yourself, but you had to be a little bit outgoing to, you know, you're perennially the new kid. And, you know, I mean, and some people find that tough, and I don't know. I guess I just kind of flourished in that role, and I like to hang out with sort of the nerdy comedian types, and we used to do our own little comic magazines in some of the schools I was in, and Mad Magazine was like a huge influence on me as a kid.
Okay.
And just that irreverent and a whole worldview with Alfred E. Newman. And so at a young age, that corrupted me. And then the 60s came along, and that really corrupted me even more. So I think that kind of informs my sensibility. A lot of people look at my stuff and go, ah, R. Crumb. And yeah, he had an influence, but like I said, Mad Magazine and the comics and stuff. But also, you know, if you look at my stuff, it's not just. I'm kind of an art guy.
Yeah.
Went to art school, took my art history, so you can see there's a lot of medieval and Renaissance kind of insane attention to detail, like in a Hieronymus Bosch painting or something like that.
Interesting.
So actually, there are little references, the little arty references and things here and there. So
yeah.
So yeah, I was sort of the class clown as in junior high and high school. I was one of those guys.
One of those guys.
I was torn.
Well, some of your current stuff, you were telling me on the phone yesterday that you just opened a show in Monterey, or actually a month ago, right?
Yeah, actually a neighboring city to the Monterey. Basically, it's kind of a suburb of Monterey, but Pacific Grove.
Okay.
So I have a museum exhibit at the Pacific Grove Museum of Natural History. It's about, you know, 8 blocks from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. But basically, it's kind of where Ed Ricketts and John Steinbeck, you know, down near Cannery Row.
Wow.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool place to have an exhibit. And that opened a month ago, runs until February. And that's from a whole project that I did. There was a mural project that I did for NOAA.
Yeah.
I did a project for the government. And we painted a big mural on a NOAA building down there, and I did all these drawings in preparation for that project. So okay. This is an exhibit of those drawings.
Oh, okay. That's at the school.
So that runs
right?
Until, like I said, February. And as usual, I painted all over the walls, and I have a soundtrack. And I've had a couple of exhibits over the years in Juneau at the Alaska State Museum. And so some of your listeners may remember that. I did, what was my last one in Juneau? I think it was my shark exhibit.
Oh, okay.
Shark alphabet exhibit, Sharkabet. I think that was up there in 07 or something like that.
Okay. Now, you were also recently awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in Science for carrying out what type of project? What will you be developing?
Yeah, I got a Guggenheim this year, so I'm a Googie. I'm a Googie fellow.
Do they call you that?
Googie head. I don't know. Only we Googies can call ourselves that.
Secret code.
Yeah. I applied for Guggenheim Fellowship with my partner in crime, at least for the last book I did, a paleontologist by the name of Kirk Johnson.
Mm.
And he's actually a paleobotanist, and he's from the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And a couple of years back, we had a book that came out called Cruising the Fossil Freeway.
Yeah.
And that basically was a book about the fossils of the Rocky Mountain states, you know, and that basically the middle continent of the U.S. And we decided we wanted to do a follow-up to that, and it dawned on us, wait a minute, we've done the Rocky Mountain states. Let's do the West Coast. So, and then we realized that was a big project. So why don't we try to get some grant support? We pitched the idea to the publisher, and they loved the idea, and they signed us up. And but the advance was on the book was rather small, as it tends to be in the book business these days.
Yeah, true.
So we decided to apply to the Guggenheim, see if we could get some support for, you know, going to these fossil locales. And actually, you know, when you talk about the West Coast, you're talking about, you know, it's easy to kind of hit the lower 48 and the highway system and all that, and California is very fossil rich.
Mm.
But when you start talking about getting up to see, up to the North Slope and the Colville River where the dinosaurs are here in Alaska,
yeah,
you know, that's very remote.
Of course.
And that takes a few dollars to get up there. So, we applied and we got it, and we've started on the project. We've already done about 4 trips so far, basically down in the lower 48, but we're making plans for this next summer and, like I said, going up to the Colville and also hitting fossil sites here in Southeast.
Wow.
And basically the mantra of the last book was, you know, fossils are everywhere and they're they're just a really wonderful way to get people involved in science, and it's like a big treasure hunt. And we've had entire families head out on the highway following our book, and you know, we hope to do that again.
Wow, that's cool. So the book will be published at a certain time, or?
Yeah, the book is it's about 2 years out.
Okay.
Everything is about 2 years out. So we have a lot of traveling to do within the next year, and I'm already doing art for it, for the book. And it'll probably morph into an exhibit and or a soundtrack. Actually, you were playing a little bit of the soundtrack to the last book and the exhibit that grew out of that before you were talking to me there.
Yeah, your music, which is another aspect of your art. You have a group called the Ratfish Wranglers, which
yes.
I'm curious to know how that name kind of came about and also how music inspires what you do with your art.
Well, there is the ratfish thing.
Yes.
And I guess if there's a totemic animal for me, it's ratfish. And I don't know if I chose the ratfish or if it chose me.
Yeah, past life, maybe.
Something about it, but somebody said I kind of look like a ratfish, so, you know, I don't know. Close friend. Actually, the scientist that named the ratfish after me said it looked like me. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Those are the kinds of friends I have. But anyway, but yeah, ratfish are just cool, weird. They're totally weird-looking creatures. And I had caught one many, many years ago and just wanted to know more about it. It's just such a weird beast. And it looks like a science experiment gone wrong.
Oh, no.
It looks like it's all stitched together or something. And they're really ancient, weird things. So anyways, I kind of, and it sounds a lot like rat fink, too, you know, rat fish, rat fink.
Yeah.
Which in my day when I was growing up, the rat finks were, you know, kind of cool rebels.
Ah.
But, and to be ratfish is to, it also sounds like the word raffish. Do you know the word?
To ravish?
No, raffish.
Raffish. No.
R-A-F-F-I-S-H.
No.
Raffish.
Enlighten me.
That's a sort of a mischievous fun. Yes, usually rascally sort of fun to be raffish. Raffish behavior.
Wow.
So,
I like that kind of
there
fun.
Was just everything about it that just tumbled into it. You know, rat fink, rat fish, yeah. So, anyways, it's the Ratfish Wranglers, and I'm not quitting my day job anytime soon. So the musical world is safe from that, but I just have always enjoyed being in garage bands and hanging out with musicians and making music, and I really do, you know, when the whole punk rock thing came along and anyone could have a band, three chords, and I was like, yeah.
You got started.
So that's kind of how I really jumped in, and I haven't really progressed much beyond the three chords.
Oh.
But I do have a great time doing it, I brought the Wranglers to Juneau for the folk festival, and actually the other thing about Wranglers is that you never know who's going to be wrangled into being in the band. The band always changes.
Oh, it's changing.
So I'm always wrangling different people.
Yeah.
You know, I sometimes grab a few Juneau players, Bob Banghart and Andrew Heist have been Wranglers before. They're Juneau musicians.
Nice.
And anyways, I just, music is, I don't know, it fuels my creative spirit in a lot of ways. And then when I'm making art, I just consume music all the time. I buy CDs a lot and albums back in the day. And you know, when I'm making the art, I'm always listening to it. I like to keep up with what's happening out there in the musical world and, you know, buy new, fresh stuff. I'm not one of those people that's kind of stuck in what I listened to in high school. I like to see what's happening. And then I like to, you know, like I said, get out there and perform it too. And it's, you know, also when I have a museum, like music, the music is just always there when we I make the art, and when I install the exhibits, it also just seems like the day the exhibit opens, there should still be music. And
yeah,
so,
of course.
So over the years, I've actually gotten museums to begin playing music in the halls when one of my exhibits is there.
That's
cool. So
excellent. Do you play this music on your radio show, which was my next question about the show you have? It's on Thursday nights, right?
Yeah, I do a show called Babblefish. You know, when I do a radio show, I don't push my own stuff, no. Well, no, it's a small town. I'm not kidding, you know. I don't play so much of my own stuff. No, I'm not going to make. But when my band is playing, yes. Then, well, I mean live, but yeah, when on my own radio show, and actually I share the slot with several other people, so I'm only on once every 4 weeks or so. And I don't know. I throw stuff in the playlist every now and then.
Your radio show. No, almost out of time, Ray. I have a couple last questions. Somebody asked about rockfish and why you seem to use that kind of fish in your art more than others.
Rockfish are wonderful animals. They're really biologically very cool. We run into, there's so many different species up here. The genus name means magnificent. You know, Sebastes is the genus name for all the rockfish, and means magnificent. And I truly think they are. They're really they can be really old fish too. And some species can be as old as 200 years old.
Wow,
which is incredible.
Wow,
they're also super tasty, but they're also very vulnerable to fishing pressure.
Huh.
So, but they're just such magnificent, you know, literally magnificent animals, and they're uniquely. I mean, like I said, we have almost we have 30 plus species up here in Alaska, and
yeah, that's quite a bit.
They're just cool.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite fish you like to eat?
Favorite fish I like to eat.
It has to be from Alaska. It can't be from Brazil or Hawaii.
Well, I do like some Brazilian. I've been to the Amazon several times, but that's another radio show.
Yeah, I've actually had a long question.
Well, I would have to say that a yellow-eyed rockfish, a red snapper is what they're also called, is probably my favorite fish. But like I said, I love it so much, but it's also, you know, they're really old fish, so we got to, you know, really watch what we do with, you know, the fishing pressure on them.
For sure.
But they are oh so tasty.
Yes, they are.
Blackened rockfish is about the nearest thing to heaven.
Yum. It's dinner time. Well, thanks, Ray. I appreciate you taking the time to call in and be a part of the Alaska Identity Project. Good luck with all your projects and I'll get one of your T-shirts soon, so I'll be sporting
Well,
it.
You better. You want to be cool, right?
So, I know, yeah. I do. Thanks again. We're speaking here with Ray Troll. The Fin Art of Ray Troll and his impact on Alaska. Troll Global Industries are redefining the cosmos. It's been great to be with you. Thanks to Susan here in the studio, Jeff Brown. We're going to leave you tonight with some music from Sweet Plantains, which is a group, a string quartet that is going to be here in Juneau tomorrow night. And actually, we're going to get that queued up real quick. And happy Halloween to everybody out there. Next week, we'll be back with another show here on the Alaska Identity Project. We'll get some other great guests. Remember, if you want to look for a promo, you can go to Alaska ID Project on Twitter or find it on Facebook, as well as the KTO News site has an Alaska Identity Project page and all the recordings of my past shows, like from last week with the Marine Conservation Alliance in Oceania. So look for those recordings, and the recording of Ray Troll and Deb Spencer should be up by tomorrow. Thanks again, and see you next week.